subjective discretion of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia when ruling on the U.S. Constitution. We've just now had the newspaper saying that George Bush has won a victory in the Senate. They've passed his education law for the betterment of our schools so kids can learn to read and write better. Only problem is the Constitution doesn't authorize a Department of Education. So how are they able to get away with this? The Constitution says clearly any powers that we do not demarcate in the 10th Amendment accrue to the states. But that's not what the United States Supreme Court says today, or our federal judiciary, or the rabbis. Rabbi Dr. Pinchas Haman, professor of Talmud in Jerusalem, says the answers to these questions necessarily stem from subjective discretion of the sage. Isn't that called situation ethics? Subjectivism? Just what we're trying to fight in our schools? And yet the very conservatives who say they're fighting situation ethics then turn and say, we're part of a Judeo-Christian tradition. And we might even want to consult the rabbis to find out how to fight situation ethics. After all, they're part of our tradition, even if later on they did go wrong. No, they're not. Because they're part of situation ethics, and I've got it right here. But it gets worse. Listen. The written Torah is the Torah of God's light. Now remember, in Jesus' time, the Talmud, as it existed, is known as the Mishnah, had not yet been written down. It had not been committed to writing. See, Israel had not lost its mind yet. Yahweh was giving Israel one last chance, and that chance was their Messiah. And some of them went with the Messiah, but the others that didn't and rejected him became so corrupt that they took an underground current that had been haunting Israel, had been kind of in the background, and they then made it the center of their new religion of Judaism. That's what happened there. So that's when they wrote it down, after the crucifixion of their Messiah, after the destruction of the temple, is when they began to commit this oral tradition of the elders, this man-made religion which nullifies the Old Testament to writing. So then, the written Torah, meaning the Old Testament, is the Torah of God's light, says this professor of Talmud, stemming from the absolute clarity that is above time and place. Well, we have no argument with that. The oral Torah is the Torah of darkness, stemming from the mist and haze of the human world. Both Torahs were given in conjunction with each order, in order to set right the world of darkness. Therefore, the oral Torah prevails over the written Torah, even to the extent of uprooting the written Torah. He said it. I didn't. He can't be anti-Semitic. He's professor of Talmud in Jerusalem. He says, in fact, he's even bragging about it, although he doesn't know you're reading it. He doesn't know I dig this out, and it would be transmitted to me from my connections, and it would be gotten to you. This is supposed to be for them only, not for us dumb goyim, okay? This isn't in John Hagee's work or Tim LaHaye's book or Chuck Misler's book. This is in their books intended for them to read until such time as they feel Jewish supremacy has gotten to the next step, and then John Hagee and Falwell and Robertson will be saying this and will be bowing down to it, because there's nothing too low for those Khazar worshippers to sink to. So the oral Torah is the Torah of darkness, and the oral Torah prevails over the written Torah. So the Talmud is more important than the Old Testament, even to the extent of uprooting the written Torah. Jesus Christ in Mark 7, Jesus Christ in Matthew 15. Let that be your banner against the Talmud, because that's when he's addressing the Talmud in its oral form as the Mishnah. And that's where he says exactly what this rabbi is doing. It's uprooting the written Torah. In the alchemical manuscripts of the Freemasons and the Rosicrucians in the Middle Ages, there's a concept called revelation of the method. They say when we are nearing our time of supreme power, we will reveal to our victims what we have done to them. because they will be so stupefied by all of our successes that they will be unable to act against us. And by virtue of telling them what we have done to them, and by them not acting against us, we enslave them doubly more. And that is what is going on and transpiring today. They are telling us what they're doing to us. Many conspiracy researchers think that this is still the age of secrecy. Well, it is to an extent. Certain hitmen and assassins and their identities have to be covered up, sure. But in general, this is the age of the revelation of the method, which is what it says in the Rosicrucian document Confessio, the 17th century document. This is the time we're going to reveal to them what we're doing. And they are. They've revealed it to us in the Kennedy assassination. They've revealed it in many ways. People know that there wasn't one lone nut and one very talented rifle bullet that killed Kennedy. But what have they done? They've muddied the water so much on the Kennedy assassination that it seems like everybody killed Kennedy. And you walk away disgusted with it. You know it was a conspiracy. You know it had something to do with the government. But you don't seek to find the perpetrators and punish them, because they've used this kind of X-Files murkiness to create 100 different solutions and suspects and so forth. That's the methodology of the revelation of the method. That's what I'm trying to teach you, so you will be up to speed with what they're doing to you, and then you become masters of this situation rather than victims. Because, my friends, that's what Jesus Christ gave to you. He paid the price in His blood for you to take dominion, and not for you to be a victim of these scum. I'm going to be giving you some pretty tough Talmud quotes here. And I know that Ted had to do that when we were down with Dave Barley. It was one day he had to discuss some kind of delicate topics when getting into the seed line hypothesis, because it does involve some sensitive material there in Genesis. He had to do it in order to have an exposition of his argument, and I'll need to do that today. Before I do that, I want to point out that Rabbi Jacob Neusner is the leading Talmud expositor in America. This is the part of the Talmud known as the Gemara, which is the commentaries on that oral law that was written down after Christ's crucifixion. That's called the Mishnah. Mishnah is the original oral law. Babylonian Talmud is commentary on the oral law. Both are authoritative, the commentaries and the law. Okay. Rabbi Neusner is the translator of the most popular Mishnah out right now. When I'm up at Dave Barley's and I only have about 40 or 50 miles to travel, I haul the Mishnah around with me. But it weighs about 8 pounds, so I didn't want to put it in my luggage and fly it on the plane today. I took the thinner third part of Tractate Sanhedrin. But had I had that Mishnah with me, you would have seen Rabbi Jacob Neusner as editor. He's the leading, as I say, Talmud expositor in America. He's also, by the way, a columnist for a right-wing magazine named Chronicles, edited by Thomas Fleming, not to be confused with another Thomas Fleming, who's a very good revisionist historian. Now, Chronicles bills itself as the revival of Western civilization, and they have this Talmudic rabbi as the columnist. What a joke. What a joke. He is Rabbi Jacob Neusner, and he says that God studies the Talmud in heaven. He says that the mode of piety, the imitation of God, and the focus of sanctity are the qualities of the Talmudic sages, to whom Rabbi Neusner refers as saints. But he qualifies this by bragging a little bit. He says their sainthood consisted in critical intelligence. That's what makes them saints, how smart they are. I've known so many smart people who were headed to hell. You know, the Bible never declares that someone is in hell or not. The Bible doesn't even say that Judas is in hell. But it seems to me that there are an awful lot of intellectuals and professors who are probably in hell. And yet, this is the criterion among the Judaicists for who is a saint, who's the smartest, who has the highest critical intelligence. Elie Wiesel, the gas chamber martyr, he claims that he was in 10 different concentration camps and miraculously avoided gassing in each one. What were the Germans running, a travel agency? It's a funny kind of extermination when you need all the gas and available troops to fight the Soviets on the Eastern Front, and you're taking Elie Wiesel on a grand tour of Poland. Well, he says that the Talmud is the source of enrichment. I think it is, too. I think it's a source of enrichment in the same way that manure is a source of enrichment. I wonder if any of you soiled your minds by watching Schindler's List. You know, I have to do a lot of these things. I hope that a lot of you don't. I mean, I do it so you don't have to, okay? And in Schindler's List, which is the Academy Award-winning film of Steven Spielberg, one of the Jewish boys is saved by jumping into a great big toilet. And the toilet is brimming full. It's a cesspool. But by jumping into that toilet and swimming around in there for a few minutes, he's able to elude the Germans and save himself. Well, toilet symbolism is central to the Talmud and central to the Jewish mentality. Most of the time, however, the toilet is not a source of salvation for Jewish persons. Rather, it's a source of constant obsession and fear. Yes, fear. There are hundreds of Talmudic laws about what to do when you go to the bathroom. Because the Khazars believe that devils live in the toilet. And they have to protect themselves in various ways. I'll give you an example from Babylonian tractate Gittin 70a. The rabbis taught, on coming from a toilet, a man should not have intercourse with his wife till he has waited long enough to walk half a mile, because the demon of the toilet is with him for that time. But if he does not walk the half mile, the children conceived after he went to the bathroom will be epileptic. The Talmud in Berakoth 60b says, on entering a toilet, one should say the following prayer, preserve me, help me, support me. When he comes out of the toilet, the rabbi said, blessed is he who has formed man in his wisdom and created him in many orifices and cavities. Now, I've told you the Talmud is a curse on these people. It's a curse, okay? Listen to this. Talmud Tractate Berakoth 61b. Our rabbis taught, one who goes to the bathroom in Judea should not do so east and west, but rather north and south. But in Galilee, he should do it east and west. Okay? Can you imagine them going around, you know? The text continues with two fascinating stories about the lengths to which the sages went to learn from the rabbis. Talmud Tractate Berakoth 62a. It's been taught Rabbi Akiva once went into the bathroom to spy upon Rabbi Joshua while he was on the toilet. And he said, I learned from him three things. I learned that one does not sit east and west, but north and south. I learned that one defecates not standing but sitting. And I learned that it is proper to wipe with the left hand and not with the right. Now, Rabbi Ben Izzi says to him, did you dare to take such liberties with your rabbi by spying upon him? And Rabbi Judah says, or Rabbi Akiva says, it was a matter of Torah. I had to learn. He had to spy on this guy in a toilet. This is what your Judeo-Christians are bowing down to. You don't believe it? Invest the $29.95 for the 35 volumes of this in paperback, or the $65 for the 35 volumes of this in hardcover, and read it for yourself. I'm giving you the references. Read it for yourself. Now, some of you may say to yourselves, well, when I get finished here, I'm going to go home and I'm going to tell my Judeo-Christian friends about this. And most likely, I'm going to have an impact on them, and I'm going to convert them. Well, I don't want to sin against hope. It may be a miracle, and you may do that. But I'm telling you this for your sake, because some of us still have vestiges in our brain of human respect for the rabbis of the Old Testament. We may know the score on them in certain degrees, but we may think, well, they're masters of Hebrew. Well, they do study that Old Testament all day long. No, this is for you. You see, the Judeo-Christians know they're wrong. Okay? In most cases, they know they're wrong. Don't plead ignorance on their behalf. They know. They're worshiping money. They're worshiping race. They want power, and they live in fear. And I do not work with Judeo-Christians. I work with you people. I work with my own kind. That's what I work with. Because you're the Christians. I don't define an idolater, a follower of this book of filth, pornography, black magic, and the murder of Jesus Christ. I do not follow the people who bow down to this, who say that the rabbis are worthy of respect. No, this is for you and for your mind, and for those among your companions who have a sufficient love of the truth. Find a human being, whether they go around saying, Lord, Lord, all the time, and we know what Christ said about people who would say that, in vain do they worship me. Maybe you'll find people who don't even regard themselves as Christians, because so many good people have been so turned off to the Bible and Christianity by the counterfeit that is put forward to them. They never knew Christ. They never knew the Old Testament. They never knew the Gospel. They've only seen the churchianity version of it, and they want no part of it. Those are better people than the people who suck up to the Israelis. They're the better people. Because you've got to have a sufficient love for the truth. And out of a sufficient love for the truth is born curiosity. I can't teach anybody. You can't teach anybody if they don't have a sufficient love of the truth, and out of that comes curiosity. And we see these dead zombies in our society. They have no curiosity about what really counts. They're real curious about a 56 Chevy. There's about 1,000 of them pouring over a 56 Chevy right now in downtown Medford. But to pour over this book, or to pour over this book, they go by what the authorities say, what the experts say. Well, I believe we are the people who uphold the banner of sola scriptura, the Bible alone, its texts alone. We examine it with our own heart and eyes using the discernment and grace that Yahweh and Jesus Christ give us. We don't need these books to discern it. Tomorrow I will be discussing we cleared some of those awful hurdles. I wish I could apologize for assaulting your ears, but I think some of you need the strong medicine. You need to understand what this thing really represents. Tomorrow we'll do the superstition and the magic that is in the Talmud. And I understand from Pastor Weiland's program that we'll also have a question and answer this evening. And I would be happy to participate in that along with the other speakers, because there are so many other misnomers when you go into battle against the rabbis. People think that goyim means cattle. It's very common in the right wing to think that the word goyim means cattle when it just means other nations. Now, the connotation of that word is cattle. We'll be talking about that. I'll have these sheets on my table. Also, if you want to learn more, this is the book that I wrote on this subject, Judaism, Strange Gods. I have a couple minutes more, and in these last couple of minutes, I would like to point out that you are the leaders. You have the obligation. I'm putting you under obligation tonight because you have the privilege to come and hear people who are not afraid of death and who are speaking words of truth with you. And this is not a game. This is not entertainment. This is not simply a study hour. This is a life and death matter. We are to fear no one but God, no one but Yahweh. To have no fear whatsoever. People often say to me, aren't you afraid of being assassinated with the way you talk, the studies you do, the internet work that you're doing? I mean, you're coming right out boldly in this way against an entire empire based on assassination of the Mossad and so forth. And I think to myself, I understand the person's question, but how silly it really is if you know the scheme of the universe. I think the first hymn we sang this morning was of the glory of Yahweh and His majesty. He made the heaven and the earth. Who should I be more afraid of? My Creator and your Creator that gave us both a mission for the truth? He made us for a reason? Or should I fear some puny man with a gun? Hey, I can get run over going to get my mail across the street if that's what Yahweh wants. And if He wants to preserve my life, He'll keep me till I'm 125 preaching the way I am, being a stumbling block to those Khazars and enlightenment to you. But you are of my substance, and you do the same. You fear no one but Him. You be a light in this way. And by that means, you'll take this candle tonight, and you will change the world. You will have dominion. You will be light. Thank you.